The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
The basic point, though, is that so many of his norm violations have not appeared to serve him well. When predecessors break norms, future presidents tend to follow the new norms when those norms bring advantage. And I don't think any, with the exception of his attacks on the media, where he's crossed the line many times, I don't think any of his norm breaches have brought him credit or helped his presidency. And I give the example, I think future presidents are no more likely to attack their attorney general the way Trump has viciously attacked his than they are to repeat Trump's behavior if he were to show up in the Rose Garden in a bathrobe to give a press conference. That would be a norm violation. No president in the future is going to have an interest in following that.
I'm Matthew Kahn, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, October 3rd, 2017. President Trump's conduct in office has drawn a stark contrast between the laws that formally restrict the executive branch and the norms through which presidents have voluntarily constrained themselves in the past. For the October 2017 issue of The Atlantic, Jack Goldsmith wrote about how the current president's disrespect for rule of law and disregard for norms of executive conduct are testing the institutions of the presidency like no previous holder of the office. Last week, Benjamin Wittes talked to Jack about his piece, including the distinction between violations of norms and violations of the law, and how journalistic practice and credibility is changing under the Trump administration. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 250, Jack Goldsmith on the Norm-Defying Presidency.
Hey, podcast listeners, Ben Wittes here with a brief explanation for why you are getting a podcast on Tuesday rather than Saturday. The answer is we've got a lot of audio content all of a sudden these days, and so we've decided on occasion to go to a 2-episode-a-week format. We won't be doing this every week, but instead of letting podcasts back up, we're going to start rolling them out when they're ready, Tuesdays and Saturdays as a general matter. We don't promise a podcast every Tuesday, but don't be surprised if one shows up in your feed. Enjoy. Let's start with the tension that lies at the heart of the first half of your article, which is on the one hand, this devastating account that you begin with about President Trump, and then your sense of this of the relative success of institutional mechanisms at restraining him. Walk us through both aspects of that. A lot of people have sort of noted, you start with this incredible indictment of him, and then kind of say, but it's actually working out okay.
I think it's working out okay so far in a relatively narrow respect, in the sense that he has not been able to engage in obviously unlawful behavior that he pledged to do from the beginning. I mean, he came into office having pledged on the campaign to basically break all sorts of laws, from, you know, in the military targeting context, torture, detention, things he might do for speech. In any event, and in the two areas where he's come closest to engaging in unlawful or in which he's raised the possibility of engaging in unlawful behavior. And these are the ones I discuss most extensively. Those are the immigration order and the Russia investigation and his meddling in that. I think the institutions have held and performed remarkably well, and he has, despite not wanting to, clearly abided so far by basically the institutions that have pushed back against him in those respects.
So what do we attribute that to? Do we say it's because Trump's bark is worse than his bite, or because the institutional mechanisms are stronger than a lot of people assumed, or is it an element of both?
I think it's mostly the second thing. I think the institutions are much stronger than people assumed. And not just that the institutions like the courts and people in the Justice Department and in Congress when it comes to the Russia investigation, you know, they're doing their part, and Trump is abiding thus far, even though he clearly doesn't like it. I think it shows the power of the institutions. Now, this raises some very profound questions of constitutional law about why a president abides by the law. Why did he listen to the courts on immigration in the sense that he abided by the orders and appealed rather than defied them? We really don't know what was in his head, but I think that the mechanism that is doing the most work here is that when he really gets on the verge of doing something insane, or appears to get on the verge of doing something constitutionally insane, like defying a court order, I think at that point his administration has the potential to melt down, and at that point, he balks. That's speculation. We don't know the inside stories yet, but I expect that there would have been massive resignations if he had defied the court order, massive resignations in the White House and in the Justice Department if he had defied the immigration court orders. I imagine the same if he had sort of serially fired Mueller and Rosenstein and the like. And I think ultimately, that's one of the things that makes the Constitution work, that there are people around him, even people that he hired, that aren't willing to go along with some of his extra legal impulses.
At the end of the day, when you observe that, do you conclude from that that he is less dangerous as a consequence? Or do you conclude from that merely that he's less dangerous as a potentially law-violating figure? You make a very sharp distinction here between his norms violation and his law violations. And, you know, is the sense of danger limited in aggregate by that, or merely the sense of danger as to the violation of law?
I'm really just focusing on the violation of law. That's really, it's not all of what checks and balances and institutional constraints are about. That's where I think that there's been success. That does not mean that he's not dangerous. He's extremely dangerous because, and I think I wrote this in my first post on Lawfare after the election, and it's obvious, words from a president matter, even if they fall within his lawful discretion. He can say and do things that are enormously harmful, and he's been doing that since the beginning of his presidency, and we could... The examples are endless, you know, including last weekend with the NFL stuff. They're just endless. The North Korea stuff seems extremely unstable because of the way he comports himself. None of that is illegal. And none of that is captured by the constitutional checks that I am exalting in the first part of the piece.
I think this is a really important distinction. I made the argument in a recent essay that people keep looking for violations of law at the margins of presidential authority. And what actually makes Trump dangerous is his exercise of the core of presidential authority. You know, the president's ability to tweet things and speak, the president's ability to remove staff, the president's ability to act on the world stage. None of these are controversial authorities within the ambit of presidential power, and we don't think about them because they're not really marginal exercise of presidential power, but they're where his danger lies.
His danger lies not in his tendencies toward extra legal action, but rather in the exercise of lawful discretion, in the exercise of the enormous discretion to act and speak that we confer on the president.
So how confident are you, based on the first 9 months of successful pushback on possible illegalities, that the threat of illegal action by the Trump administration or by Trump personally is a controllable threat? Do you look at this history and say institutions have performed relatively well? And you make a really interesting case, actually, which I think is correct, that Congress has done better than people give it credit for, and certainly the courts. And so do you look at that and say, therefore, if we have 3 or 7 more years of this, you're confident that the capacity for restraining illegality is realistic and robust? Or do you look at it and say, we've done okay so far, but I'm not confident that we will continue to?
So I'm relatively confident. Let me make some caveats. You know, one is there's lots of executive behavior. This was certainly true of Obama. This is certainly true of Bush. It's true of every president, frankly, that at the margins, when presidents are acting aggressively, there's going to be legal controversy. I mean, that's just true of every president in modern times, and maybe every president ever. He's going to do things like every president in exercising his powers that are at the margins of legality, probably in an uncertain area. And that the institutions will engage that and will get a result, and I have confidence in those outcomes. So with that caveat that, you know, there's going to be some blurriness at the margins, I am fairly confident in our institutions' ability to control his illegal actions. I have a large caveat to that at the very end of the piece, which is everything is kind of stable now. The markets are fine, despite the Korea situation. The international scene is relatively stable for the United States. And, you know, one can imagine worst case scenarios where he gets out of control and there's a constitutional crisis about whether he can continue as president because he's just been doing crazy things. And when and how the institution will react to that, you know, I still have confidence, but I don't know. I just really don't know.
So you are much less sanguine on the norm front, and where you really describe him as very consistently norm busting, which I don't think is a controversial statement at all. Interestingly, and I think a little bit more controversially, are relatively confident that these norm violations, which he systemically engages in, will not have staying power with respect to future presidents. And I want you to talk through that a little bit. What, you know, you write with a pretty high degree of confidence that the next president and the ones after him will not behave like Donald Trump. I'm interested in how strong your confidence is on that and where it comes from.
There's one caveat that I'll get to in a second. But yes, I do think the reason... So first of all, let's be clear. Norms are non-legal prescriptions of presidential behavior. They're things we expect a president to do, even though the law doesn't require him to do it. Presidents in the past have broken norms, and sometimes and often in the past, norm breaking, I give some examples in the piece, norm breaking is seen as an important advance for the country. I mean, Roosevelt's third term is the classic example where there was a norm against running for a third term, and he decided to break the norm, and there were good reasons for it, and it proved to be a good decision. And there are other examples of that. So we shouldn't assume that norm breaking is always bad. That's the first thing. Second thing is a lot of the norms that Trump has broken, for example, attacking his attorney general in public and humiliating him, admitting that he fired the FBI director because he didn't like what was going on in the Russia investigation. So many of the norms he breaks, there's a question whether those are even norm violations. I didn't talk about this in the piece, but those are just, you know, most presidents act a certain way because it's in their self-interest, and Trump doesn't do that for a whole variety of psychological reasons, I think. The basic point, though, is that so many of his norm violations have not appeared to serve him well, and that presidents tend to continue norm patterns, norm break. When predecessors break norms, future presidents tend to follow the new norms when those norms bring advantage. And I don't think any, with the exception of his attacks on the media, where he's crossed the line many times, with that, the exception of that, I don't think any of his norm breaches have brought him credit or helped his presidency. And I give the example, I think future presidents are no more likely to attack their attorney general the way Trump has viciously attacked his than they are to repeat Trump's behavior if he were to show up in the Rose Garden in a bathrobe to give a press conference. That would be a norm violation. No president in the future is going to have an interest in following that.
But let me challenge you on one norm violation that the president has engaged in that I look at and I say, I wonder if this one does have staying power, and that's his use of Twitter. So I agree with you that the next president is most unlikely to want to tweet insane things, in a completely unfiltered way. But I do think that Trump probably has a point that his ability to have a direct relationship with his constituency, speak to the public directly, go around the media, is partly a function of his having 39 million people on a Twitter feed that he's manning directly around the White House staff. Now, this is a profoundly different way of interacting with the populace than any president has ever engaged in before. But I'm not 100% convinced that the next president doesn't say, I'll dial it back a little bit, but the basic idea that, there should be a very direct relationship between citizen and president through an electronic medium like Twitter is an advent of Donald Trump that I'm going to take advantage of and did work for him.
So, I mean, I disagree with your interpretation of those events on a number of grounds. One, I don't think it's a norm violation that Donald Trump is using Twitter to reach his constituents for a number of reasons. There wasn't a norm before of presidents not communicating on Twitter with their constituents. Obama communicated, not in the same robust way as Trump, but he certainly communicated through Twitter. And it's not like there's been a norm of not communicating through Twitter. It's not old enough. So I don't think that there's a pattern that he's violating is the first point there. Second point is there's a very long-term trend that political science has talked about under the rubric of the rhetorical presidency, starting with Wilson, continuing through Roosevelt, JFK, Reagan are the highlights of presidents using means of communication to cut through the media filter to reach the American people directly through various means, fireside chats, Reagan's speeches, and the like. So this is, I think, the next step in the rhetorical presidency, with the president having this powerful tool to basically communicate directly and personally, in some sense, with millions and millions of people. I don't see it as a norm violation. I do think presidents will continue to use Twitter and social media. But again, why is that a norm violation?
I think the specific mode in which he's doing it is a profound change. That is the direct, unfiltered access, no speechwriters, no public relations intermediaries, right? Direct presidential id to voter communications, including with typos, with the accidental type covfefe sort of words. I mean, that's not the way we normally think of the president interacting with the public.
Yeah. So let me just say, my general proposition is I have never thought of that as Trump violating norms. It's a change. And if you want to view every change as a norm violation, we can stipulate to that. My general point is future presidents will repeat Trump's innovations if it brings them advantage. If using Twitter brings them an advantage, and abusing Twitter in a very personal way, I'm still a little skeptical that we're going to have any president as unbuttoned as Trump for a while. But But I have no doubt that future presidents will see the advantage in using Twitter more aggressively than Obama did, and they will learn from Trump in that respect. So if we want to call that a norm violation or a new norm, I'm okay with that. And my general point is that future presidents will continue the practices that brought Trump benefit and that they see as bringing them benefit, and the vast majority of his norm violations that won't be true of. Now, the one that has been successful for him, and it relates to Twitter, is his extreme media bashing. And I do think that will be a feature. It has been for a while, but it will be a top line feature of Republican presidential candidates for a very long time.
All right, so we'll get to the media in a moment, but let's talk generally. One of the really interesting things you do in this article is that you evaluate not merely the norms violations of the president, but the reciprocal norm violations by actors in opposition to the president that the president's actions have triggered. And you focus particularly on the judiciary and the press and the bureaucracy. So let's talk through that. The response, and as you know, I tend to agree with you that judges have leaned very far forward in their response to some of Trump's behavior, specifically in the Immigration Executive Order Department. But the response that a lot of people who were sympathetic to the judiciary on this would say is, wait a minute, extreme presidential action produces orderly litigation up and down the appellate ladder that the Supreme Court had to correct a little bit, but judges were working under very difficult circumstances. Why should we look at the behavior of those judges in terms of a norms violation rather than just seeing it as kind of the rough and tumble of litigation when the executive is behaving in a dramatic norms-busting fashion?
So of the three examples I give, the judicial case is the hardest one to prove, and it's the one, you know, I'm least certain about. And that you just identified the problem. The problem is that Trump is so extreme, and it's very difficult to measure whether the reaction to him is itself extreme or whether it's just an appropriate response to his extreme behavior. And let me just say before I answer that, my general point is Trump is attacking institutions in way and using the all sorts of institutions. I talked about some in the piece, there are others. He's attacking them in vicious ways, in ways that puts them all back on their heels and discombobulates them and causes them to act and sometimes overreact. I think it's part of his evil genius, and I think it's purposeful. And I think that if you're in the business of destroying elite institutions, as he sees himself as doing, it's an effective strategy. Okay, now let me answer your question. You know, without getting into the legal merits of the order, but the courts, they I'm not complaining about the results they reached, that we could argue about the results they reached. I'm complaining about the method. And that is these wildly overbroad opinions that enjoin the entire order without even having analysis underlying it that tied into the scope of the injunction. I'm talking about not even pretending to give the president deference. I'm talking about what I viewed as a finger-wagging tone. These are all things that are part of the judicial prerogative. But when you're dealing with a president like this in this situation and he's attacking institutions, it's my view that you need to bend over backwards to be circumspect and to maintain the informal norms that inform your legitimacy, as I will say the Supreme Court did in that extraordinary opinion last June. And the difference between that opinion, whatever the merits end up being, the difference between that opinion in tone and sobriety, they were under time pressure as well. And the lower court opinions was remarkable.
I agree with you about the difference between the Supreme Court and the lower courts. But I think the other example that people don't talk about as much is the difference between Judge Curiel's behavior during the campaign and the Trump University litigation. which was really circumspect, really careful, really, you know, did not partake of any of the activity that you're describing, even though the attacks on him were incredibly personal. And in contrast to some of the litigations that you're describing, where the judges seem to get a little bit fevered and caught up in the moment.
That's a perfect example, Ben. I wish I'd used it. And I think there's a general lesson there that, you know, it's very hard to do, but an institutional response to Trump cannot give him and his supporters, should not give him and his supporters ammunition to say, I told you so. Look, they're breaking norms. It is very important to the legitimacy of those institutions and to fight what I think Trump is trying to do, that judges act like the Supreme Court and the judge during the campaign and not like some of the lower court. And I don't want to exaggerate this. This is the point in the paper where I think, you know, it's most debatable, but I do think there's something to it. And I think it's very important for all institutions to take a deep breath and try to stay true to their fundamental norms.
So let's talk about the fundamental norms of the bureaucracy, where I think the case that you make is more inarguable, right? So here we have seen this incredible torrent of leaks. We've also seen, as you quote, a certain amount of talking to the press about the bureaucratic resistance that we, the bureaucracy, are going to engage in. And the one question I have for you in this regard is, you know, I've been curious as to whether the degree of internal bureaucratic opposition is actually been a little bit overstated by the fact that the leaking on the part of the Trump people themselves is so out of control and so endemic that a lot of things look like bureaucratic leaks are actually White House and congressional leaks that are more a creature of the White House as viper's nest than they are a creature of bureaucratic resistance to Trump.
Yeah, so it's very hard to tell. And a lot of these leaks are being interpreted, as you suggested, against the backdrop of the first month of the administration with this torrent of stories about how bureaucrats are going to be resisting like never before. They're using encrypted communications. They're coordinating with the Obama administration. They're tweeting out information to enable coordination for resistance. And the leaks concerning the Russia investigation all take place against that background. And it seems like, and it might not be, but it seems like it's part of an organized resistance. A lot of those stories, however, and the ones that, look, leaking, as we know, is as old as the hills. And bureaucratic resistance is as old as the hills. There are some new tactics here that I think are being used, but that might be a natural development. What I think is new are the FISA leaks and the American person information aspects of that. And those stories, I haven't gone back and checked, but a lot of them are sourced to current and former intelligence officials. And it's hard to see those coming from both for that reason and for the reason that it's not obvious in their self-interest, though I'm a little less confident about that, are those coming from the Trump people?
I think that's right, and I very much agree with you that there is that the leak of the contents of a FISA intercept is a dramatic different is a dramatically different matter from anything we have seen in regular news reporting in modern history, and it really is it really raises norm issues of its own. It's now happened more than once. I have my doubts about the integrity of CNN's recent story about the Manafort wiretap, but if it's accurate that there was a FISA wiretap on Manafort, that's just the latest example of a some kind of leak of the substance or fact of a FISA wiretap, and I think that really is a qualitatively different animal than we've dealt with before.
It is, and can I just say one more thing here? And this is a point you and Susan have emphasized. It is really quite a dramatic change, and It's a norm that governed even the Wild West of leaks, and it was a remarkably robust norm, I would say. And I also think, I think you agree with this, I know Susan thinks this, that it's especially inappropriate in a context where there are several ongoing investigations, robust investigations, with full access to this information, and every reason to think that those investigations will use this information appropriately to reach the right result. So it's an extremely unfortunate development, but it's been highly successful, I think it's fair to say. I mean, Flynn was quickly removed, and it's done great damage to the Trump administration. And the worry, of course, is that it will be used in the future by different people for different political ends.
This is part of what interests me about this. You seem much less confident that there will be a snapback to regular norms in the response to Trump department than you are in the behavior of the presidency department. And my question is, why shouldn't we assume that that kind of, you know, extravagantly divergent behavior and leaking is a creature, however inappropriate, and I will not defend it, is a creature of the response to Trump. And when you have a more normal executive that is not violating all sorts of norms himself and that people aren't afraid of illegal activity by him, there will be more respect, as there was under Obama, as there was under Bush, as there was under Clinton before him. Why are you more afraid of the persistence of changed bureaucratic norms than of the persistence of changed presidential norms?
You're absolutely right to describe my position. I am much more worried about these norm violations not being reversed for the other actors besides the president. And the answer is a straightforward calculation about whose interests are served by complying with these norms in the next administration. As I said, I don't think future presidents who are individuals, and we only have to focus on one entity there, that the individual who is the president, I believe, will not have the incentive to engage in the vast majority of Trump's norm violations simply because they don't bring benefit. By contrast, when you're looking at the bureaucrats, there are dozens, thousands, maybe hundreds that have access to various types of information. They're decentralized, and the norms have been very important in keeping that whole group from leaking certain types of information, even when leaks are regular. And it only takes one. It only takes one to have seen, one of dozens or hundreds, to have seen, hey, that worked when something really bad was going on, and the world didn't fall apart, and the person never got caught when he released or she released U.S. person information. I think something really bad is going on, and I'm going to do the same thing. The point is, there are many more actors involved, and they might well have an incentive to violate the norm going forward. That's what the worry is. But let me say, Ben, you're right. We just can't tell. It might also be that this is, you know, that with a quote-unquote normal president who's himself or herself is engaging in norm-respecting behavior, this all might just be a reaction by the intelligence agency to Trump. So it's an open question whether these norm breaches will continue. I worry about them because there are many more actors involved, and one of them might have an incentive to continue going forward.
So speaking of an area where there are a lot of actors involved, let's talk about the press. Because so I've thought a lot about your thesis about the press, with which I largely agree. I think it is impossible to look at the press's behavior over the last year, and maybe it started before that, and not see that the press has made a decision that it is not going to treat Trump similarly to the way it treats other presidents. And there seems to be no presumption of regularity regarding any presidential statement. There's no presumption that when the administration says something, there may even be a negative presumption as to its truth. And the desire on the part of media organizations to throw resources at endless investigation of the president seems endless. And that strikes me as categorically different from any administration that we've ever seen before in our lives. And that said, my question isn't that reasonable? So you started your article by saying we've never seen a president more mendacious. And if that's your starting point, it's certainly my starting point, that isn't the reasonable journalistic judgment to flow from that we've got to, at some level, treat this like you're reporting on a criminal organization, or that's a little bit hyperbolic, but you've got to treat it in a completely different way than you would treat, say, the Bush administration or the Obama or Clinton administrations. What's analytically wrong with the press constructing its norm violation? Why doesn't its norm violation flow entirely naturally from the circumstances?
Yeah, great question. I try to answer this in the piece. First of all, before I get into the criticisms in the piece, I make quite clear that the press has done an extraordinary job of covering Trump, and really an amazing job of figuring out what's going on and putting it in perspective and explaining it. You know, sometimes it goes too far, often it goes too far. But before I talk about that, I want to acknowledge that point. I also want to acknowledge, as I did in the piece, that if you have a lying, mendacious, institution-attacking president, and if you just cover that, it could be that this is just a natural response, and that the reason we see unprecedentedly negative coverage by a large margin of the Trump administration compared to past administrations is because this is just an unprecedentedly terrible president. And there's definitely something to that, and it's also true that, as I forget the name of the New York Times media person, but as he said, when a president's constantly lying and you're constantly pointing out his lies and being negative, you come off as being oppositional rather than independent. And so there's an appearance problem, even if they're playing it straight. So I acknowledge all of that. And yet I do think I agree with Bob Woodward. This is an aesthetic judgment, if you will, that the press has gone too far. They're drinking the anti-Trump Kool-Aid, as he put it. By which I mean there's kind of this group mentality to go after Trump that is apparent in the nature of the news stories, in the intermixture of opinion with fact that I don't think we've seen the same degree of, in newspapers essentially advertising themselves as part of the opposition. That's the way I read what the Washington Post has been doing, and Slate, and frankly a lot of other magazines, and they're benefiting from it financially enormously. In Twitter, when supposed news reporters are regularly making fun of the president and treating him with disrespect and letting us know their opinions, all of their news gets read through that. And so I do think that those norm violations have harmed the credibility of the media, not for you and me, but for a very large part of the country. And so that's the basic criticism.
If you could change one thing about the behavior of the major media, print media or online media, not television, such that they were observing the institutional role that was the proper response to an uncommonly mendacious and awful president, but not partaking of any of the vices that you just described. Okay, you take away the individual reporters' Twitter feeds, you require that they not express opinions on them. What else do you do? Like, what's the lever that you could wave at the Washington Post or the New York Times that would ameliorate this problem, in your view?
I don't have a good answer to that question, and I'm not sure it's ameliorable because they've benefited from this posture, from this very aggressive anti-Trump posture, and benefited from it enormously financially and in terms of influence as well. And I don't think that there's a silver bullet solution. I think it's part of this larger splintering of American media. And I think it's also, this is a remarkable thing. I'm going to write about this when I get a chance. I looked at a lot of interviews with Marty Baron and Dean Baquet before I wrote this piece. It is hard to exaggerate how shell-shocked they and their reporters are. I mean, really damaged by the attacks of Trump on their institutions, about whether they are truth reporters, about what their role is, about how they negotiate in this area. They are at sea. Did they empower Trump? Do they normalize him if they're not super critical? Are they being critical enough? They're really at sea, I think, in terms of their self-conception of their role. And there's no silver bullet solution. All of these institutions are changing so quickly, and it's happening not just because of Trump and Trump's extraordinary attacks, but the right is getting, the conservative outlets are becoming more profuse and more extreme, and people are finding their news in different places. And I think every one of the media institutions tend to be becoming slightly more extreme, it seems, in reaction to Trump. There's no silver bullet solution that I see.
So I have a prediction to make on this point, and I'd like to close with your reactions to it, whether you think it's crazy, whether you think it's plausible, whether you think it's likely right. If we hypothesize a next president of either party who will snap back in norms, in behavior with respect to norms, across a number of areas, and one of the areas will be dealing honestly with the public through the press, and that this hypothetical new president, as part of his reaction against the current administration or her reaction against the current administration, will basically send the message to the press, regular order. When words come out of the president's mouth, you can assume that those words were vetted through a reasonable process, that we are not intentionally trying to lie to you, that we're not shooting from the hip, and that we will, you know, never attack you personally for doing your jobs. My hypothesis is that the press will breathe an enormous sigh of relief and engage with that president on the basis of a sustained and protracted honeymoon for as long as that, as people believe in that that president is engaging that commitment in good faith. And that there will surely, if it's a left-wing president, there will be the Breitbarts and the Fox Newses. And if it's a conservative president, there'll be the Nations and whatever. But since the press tends to lean left, there will be, of course, concerns of liberal media bias, as there always are. But we will, if you imagine a normal presidency, you will have a normal media within a certain reasonable degree of margin of error in response to it. I'm interested in your thoughts on that hypothesis.
Great question, and I have two basic answers. The first answer is, if that happens, we can thank Donald Trump a little bit for it, because it's very clear, at least listen to the New York Times editors and reporters, that they have learned a lot about their own blind spots and biases because of Donald Trump, and that they realize that they need to take steps to ameliorate those biases and blind spots. And I think that it's potentially the case that they will be somewhat more fair-minded, although I don't have a lot of confidence in that, going forward, simply because they've become aware of these biases. And that yes, there may be a honeymoon if the right kind of president comes in. But the second point is really this. I also studied for this piece a lot of conservative writings on the media, and this is the foundational point of the foundational point of many on the right conservative thinkers. The elite media is the enemy number one, and I think, as I said earlier, that Donald Trump has shown that there is great advantage to any Republican president from attacking the New York Times and the Washington Post. So I don't think I worry that we're not going to ever go back to that honeymoon period, because I think the Republicans don't think there's much in it for them. Now, I might be wrong about that. We'll see whose prediction comes true. I definitely think there would be a honeymoon if we had a traditional Republican president, and certainly a Democrat president. But this is one area where I think that Trump's norm breaking will continue for future Republican presidents. Who knows what the Republican Party is going to be, but for future conservative presidents, that is, vicious, relentless attacks to discredit the elite media. I think that's worked very well for him in a number of ways. And I think that it is something that the next conservative president will continue. So that would make me think we won't have that honeymoon.
Jack, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Ben, as always.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. If you haven't yet, please take a moment to follow the Lawfare Podcast on Twitter, share us on Facebook, and take a moment to give us a rating in iTunes, on Stitcher, or on whatever podcast distribution system you may use. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. Thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.